Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Spingola Zone. It is Tuesday, December 17th, 2013. This is Deanna Spingola. This weekly program is sponsored by the American Free Press, whose website is AmericanFreePress.net. I am a subscriber to that wonderful, wonderful newspaper, probably the last free speech newspaper in America. And it is a wonderful gift to give. If you are thinking about a wonderful gift to give to someone that lasts an entire year, then you can get this gift for a year, an AFP gift subscription. Just go to the website, AmericanFreePress.net, and click on up at the top, it shows you where you can get a gift subscription. And this is something that you can put under the Christmas tree or in the Christmas stocking of someone that you really care about, somebody that you want to share the truth with. And oftentimes when we try to tell our friends or our family about things that we know about, things that we would like to share, they won't take it from us. They won't accept it from us. But if they read it in a newspaper, they might actually accept the things that you've been trying to share with them. So this is a wonderful way of sharing the truth with friends and family at this time of the year. And remember, it is a gift that is for the entire year, a one-year AFP gift subscription. Please consider that for friends and family. It is a gift of knowledge. What better thing could you give someone? Also, I recommend the Barnes Review, whose website is barnesreview.org. Barnes is spelled B-A-R-N-E-S, barnesreview.org. They have fabulous books. Also consider the books for a Christmas gift. It is also the gift of knowledge. So please visit those websites, both of those websites, barnesreview.org and AmericanFreePress.org. .net. I don't know where I would be without them. It was the Barnes Review and their journal that really got me started on this pathway of truth, particularly in regards to World War II. So I'm forever grateful for the Barnes Review. My guest today is Robbie Noel. His website is robbienoel.com. Robbie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Diana. Thank you so much. Been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. Now, you are down in Mexico.
Yes, Rosarita Beach, to be exact.
And what is the temperature down there today?
We have a very pleasant 70 degrees.
Oh,
typical Southern California weather, a little occasional morning fog that requires a sweater, but pretty much the rest of the time it's t-shirts and jeans is the required attire.
Oh my goodness, what would it be like? Now, I grew up in California in Sacramento. And then I lived in Lodi, California, and the weather there was fabulous. I mean, a couple months out of the year, we would have fog, and it'd be a little chilly, but it hardly ever got below freezing. Now I am sitting here in frigid Chicago, where we have probably 4 inches of snow on the ground, and it's just really cold. All right.
I spent a winter in Merrimack, New Hampshire, back in the early 90s, and I swore I would never go back to any part of the country that had to deal with the white stuff.
Exactly. Now, initially, you are from what country?
Born and raised in what is now Zimbabwe, but when I left it, it was called Rhodesia. Spent the following 20-odd years in...
Are you there? What happened to him? Have we lost our guest? Have we lost Robbie? Dave, are you there? I think we've lost
him. I'm going to get him back.
Okay, we've lost our guest momentarily. So we will get him back. So anyway, he does live in Mexico, and he was telling us that he left South Africa, Rhodesia, which became Zimbabwe, when he was about 20, and came to, I don't know where he traveled to after that. But there's so many things. I mean, he's got so many stories and things that he can tell us, particularly in as much as Mandela has recently died. And there's so there's been a lot of stories about South Africa and about the slaughter going on over there. And of course, the slaughter started decades ago. I'm most familiar with what occurred during the Boer Wars and Britain's interest in South Africa. And, of course, South Africa is a country that has so many natural resources. We're talking diamonds and gold and all kinds of things. And of course, the British, always looking for resources, went into South Africa early on. There were two Boer Wars, and managed to get their clutches on a lot of the resources there. And unfortunately, it has been an area of turmoil since then, and before that, in the mid 1800s. And that is where they first found diamonds in about 1867 in the area of the Orange River in South Africa, when somebody found some diamonds. And this was also at the time, right about the time of the Zulu Wars. And of course, the British went in. And the British said, we'll protect the Boers from the Zulus. Anyway, it's always been an area of conflict, and I think that we all know that a lot of diamonds come from that area, and we also hear about the conflict diamonds, and when you really think about the amount of diamonds that are in that country, and the fact that there's a monopoly on those stones, and they can pretty much charge whatever they wish, and people are willing to pay for them simply because we believe in in their value, as we've been told. Okay, I guess the line is busy. Maybe he is attempting to call us. I'm not sure. Hopefully we can get him back, because I don't know enough about what he's going to talk about to talk about it. But there were several different people that lived in South Africa, the Dutch and the Afrikaans with the double A, which is a word for farmer. The Boer is also a word for farmer. And these were descendants of German-speaking settlers, and usually in the Eastern Cape frontier. And do we have him back yet? Okay, in July 1871, merchants founded a diamond mine at Kimberley. It was a city in South Africa, and they began to find diamonds along the banks of the Vaal River, V-A-A-L. So by October of 1871, Britain annexed that region just so that they could take advantage of all those diamonds. Okay,
hi,
Robbie.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry about that. Unfortunately, it's one of those little issues you have doing a broadcast south of the border.
Okay, well, hey, at least you're warm, okay? You can't have everything, right?
Well, yes, absolutely, and my apologies for that.
Oh, That's okay. So you left that area when you were about 20. You left Rhodesia, or Zimbabwe, as they changed the name. And Rhodesia was actually named after Cecil Rhodes, right?
Yep.
And it's because of his influence down there, his seizure of a lot of land and natural resources, correct?
Well, that was the standard operating principle at that time in history, where countries from Europe spent a great deal of time exploring Africa and planting their flags in what they presumed was uninhabited territory. You had the British, you had the Portuguese, you had the Belgians, you had the Germans, who all claimed various parts of southern Africa as their own.
Right, because it was uninhabited. Something like how Palestine was uninhabited when the Jews wanted to take over, right?
Yeah, the history, as a matter of fact, the history of southern Africa is not that dissimilar to the history of the United States, and likewise not dissimilar to the history of the Middle East, and in particular Israel.
Right. Okay, so tell us why you left that area.
Well, in the late 60s, early 70s, with Nelson Mandela's ever-increasing popularity, South Africa was pretty much the first European country on the planet to officially declare a war on terrorism.
Really?
Because it was in large part in support of much of U.S. foreign policy at the time, also declared a war on communism and banned the creation of any political parties that aligned themselves to communism.
But wasn't Mandela a communist?
The ANC obviously was the first political party. I mean, just to give you a little bit of history so we can put it into context.
Okay.
Much like in America when it went to war with the British and defeated the British, the Boers did the same thing to the British that had claimed pretty much all of southern Africa. And so the government that was formed after the defeat of the British was conflicted in its form of government. Unfortunately, the Boers didn't have any people of the caliber of Jefferson or Madison or Washington, for that matter. And because of their Dutch heritage, they were more inclined towards national socialism.
Really? Okay.
There was a small percentage of the people that wanted the form of the new South African government to be a union with ties to Great Britain. But because they were such a minority, the overwhelming numbers of Dutch in South Africa formed what we now know as the Nationalist Party. The problem with the form of government that South Africa created after it defeated the British was aligning themselves with the Dutch Reformed Church. As you know, it was one of the things that Jefferson was very concerned about in the many letters that he wrote to clergy in the U.S. at the time, as he tried to explain his reason for separation of church and state. And his fears of what ultimately would happen if a government became too aligned with the church. South Africa is a perfect example of what Jefferson was fearful of, because it was ultimately the policies of the Dutch Reformed Church that introduced the world to what we know as apartheid.
Really? Okay.
And
that just means separation of the races, correct?
Well, the separation of the races was a policy of Dutch Reformed Church that was introduced in the 1940s, entitled the Group Areas Act, which effectively designated areas where blacks could live and areas where whites could live.
Okay, and that was just as late as the 1940s when apartheid became policy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It wasn't until the 1960s when they really started increasing the level of apartheid by requiring all blacks to carry national ID cards so as they could be identified if they were picked up as to whether or not they were in an area where they were allowed to be.
Okay.
As you can imagine, this caused a lot of angst amongst the populace. And it was this angst amongst blacks in South Africa at the time that Nelson Mandela obviously tapped into that angst.
And okay, so he wanted to exploit it for, well, I think that the races, there's always somebody around that's going to exploit the differences in races. And that's happened here in this country. And I wonder how things would have been if people were just left to exist and to collaborate with each other on their own.
Unfortunately, Mandela's ideology, first of all, to understand Mandela, you've got to understand that he, in South Africa at the time, in his 20s, was very ambitious and he wanted to become a lawyer. But the only way he could do that was through correspondence school.
Okay.
He moved from his hometown in the Transkei, which is where they buried him on Sunday, and he moved to Johannesburg, where a Jewish law firm recognized his potential, took him under their wing, sent him to law school so that he could pass the bar exam.
Okay.
And so there's no question that they ultimately shaped his politics.
Okay. And of course they wanted to, they were exploiting him.
Oh, there's no question about that. And especially at the time, you've also got to understand that the main source of employment in South Africa in those days was the mining industry. The Mine Workers Union was predominantly controlled by the Dutch.
Really? Okay. Any particular ethnic group among the Dutch or?
No, just they formed the union in order to preserve white mine workers of black mine workers. However, the black mine workers union that ultimately was formed with very little power per se outside of their numbers started to demonstrate and seek equal status. And Mandela tapped into that angst as well. And it was at this time that there were a lot of restrictions on blacks in South Africa in the 60s, and one of them was blacks could not travel outside of South Africa. Mandela, however, managed to get out of the country and spend some time in Russia.
Ah.
On his return to South Africa, he was captured, and it is still debated to this very day who was responsible for letting the authorities know where Mandela was. And it's pretty much established that the CIA was responsible for alerting the South African government to the whereabouts of Nelson Mandela.
Okay.
After his capture, because of his travels outside of the country, he was charged with treason and attempting to overthrow the South African government. He went to trial, which what today is known as the Rivonia trial, where he was questioned about his communist affiliations. The prosecutor actually asked him at one point whether or not he was merely a tool for the Communist Party, to which Mandela responded, "Why do you think I was a tool of the Communist Party rather than the Communist Party was a tool of Mandela's own doing?" But obviously over the years, because of Mandela's many close relationships with various world leaders, it's pretty much cut and dry that he was sympathetic towards the communist ideology. As a matter of fact, on his world tour after he was released from prison, the people he thanked for their assistance were Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, Muammar Gaddafi. And as a matter of fact, what is interesting, I watched a documentary on Al Jazeera the other evening. They were interviewing Jimmy Carter, and he said one of the things that he was disappointed about after Mandela's release was he never mentioned that he was grateful for the assistance that many organizations in the U.S. did in order to help Mandela's release.
So there were a lot. He had a lot of support in the United States. Was that support ethnically associated? In other words, did a lot of the blacks in the United States support him, or who was supporting him here in the United
States? The interesting fact about Barack Obama is even before he became president on Mandela's 90th birthday, he sent him a video greeting where he credited Mandela and the ANC for being his motivation for entering the political arena, and that his first political action that he can remember was help organize anti-apartheid demonstration at his college.
That's interesting. I never associated the two. But I honestly have not studied a lot about Mandela.
Well, let me throw this in, because I know this always confuses a lot of people, especially in light of all the media attention that has been focused on Mandela over the past week. When I returned to South Africa 3 years ago after being absent from 30 years, obviously I noticed a lot of things had changed. And in particular, what I noticed was the affection a lot of white South Africans had for Mandela, because when I returned in 2010 was when he was first admitted to hospital. The reason for white South Africans' support of Nelson Mandela is because in the 70s, when Nelson Mandela was imprisoned in Robben Island, the guy that pretty much took over the day-to-day running of the ANC's operation was a guy by the name of Chris Honey. And at that time, the ANC was in serious negotiation with the South African government on a path to end apartheid, because of obviously all the world pressure on South Africa to do away with the apartheid system. And Chris Honey was assassinated outside his home by a right-wing Afrikaner. And South Africa was close to a full-blown civil war at that time. And if it was
over
not...
What? Over what?
Over the assassination of Chris Honey.
Okay.
And if it was not for statements made by Nelson Mandela at the time, the media actually paid more attention to Mandela than they did to P.W., both the president of South Africa at the time. And a lot of people in South Africa credit Mandela for solely being responsible for averting what everybody believed would have been a civil war of epic proportion, no different to many other African states that ultimately had moved from colonial power to a local control. And the reasons white and black South Africans hold Mandela in such high esteem is because they credit him with being responsible for averting that bloodbath. However, one also needs to point out that when Mandela became president of South Africa, and he only served one term in office, which by in itself is unusual for any African leader. Usually they remain in power for life. He elected to only be president for a year. And
why is that, do you think?
Well, I think he felt that the groundwork had been laid for a path of action that could lead to a united South Africa. However, politicians being politicians, and it doesn't matter whether they're American politicians or African politicians, as soon as people get in positions of power and have access to the treasury, corruption is soon to follow.
Sure.
And South Africa today is...
It's kind of a lot of murder going on over there, isn't there? A lot of slaughter? Whites against blacks and all that?
South Africa financially is in a very tough position right now. They currently have 25% unemployment. There's no question there are areas in South Africa that are extremely dangerous. I mean, there are areas you don't go to.
Now, why did you go back 3 years ago? Just for a visit? Just to see family?
Yeah, I wanted to see what had happened. I wanted to, obviously, I have two brothers that still live in South Africa, and I hadn't seen them in quite some time. I decided at the time it was the right time to go and spread my wings and take a look at the rest of the planet, because there's no question I was greatly influenced by various libertarian writers, Doug Casey being the number one culprit, but many others who have written extensively about reasons to look towards South American countries as a better proposition than remaining in the U.S.
Okay.
And the folks over, I have to also give credit where credit is due. I don't know, do you ever go over to the Dollar Vigilante website?
No, never have.
Jeff Burnswick runs that, and obviously it's a page dedicated to Americans that have elected to leave the U.S. and move to Belize, Costa Rica.
Well, I can see why a lot of people are leaving the country, because, quite frankly, the prosperity that we used to enjoy in this country is being outsourced. Production is being outsourced. We're becoming a third world country. And some of those same factors that have created the situation in this country, I believe, also created that situation in South Africa. And I also think that probably before apartheid, there wasn't the violence, and now we hear of blacks absolutely slaughtering the whites in South Africa, just without mercy, raping, pillaging, slaughtering, destroying property. Is that the case?
Well, you know, I have to say, living here in Rosarito Beach, which is just 20 miles south of San Diego, I get to watch local San Diego news channel. And the San Diego news channel, to be perfectly honest with you, on a nightly basis is nothing more than a crime report talking about the crime taking place in San Diego, from robberies to murder, kidnapping, child sex rings, and the like. And one would be hard-pressed to find any difference between, you know, the funny thing is, before I left the U.S. to go to South Africa, everybody used to say to me, why are you going to South Africa? It's so dangerous over there. And when I was in South Africa and I was telling all my friends that I was moving to Mexico, they all said to me, but why are you moving to Mexico? It's so dangerous over there. So, you know, the dangers in South Africa are no different to the dangers in Mexico, and are no different to the dangers in America. For instance, I'm sure there are areas in Chicago that you would never go to.
Actually, I've been to those areas. When I was a representative for some textile companies, I did have some customers that lived in South Chicago, and I would have to call on this one particular customer before noon, before the drug dealers got up. Apparently they slept late. And the windows of her store, well, actually, she had bars on the windows of her store. She kept the door locked, and somebody, one of her employees, had to stand at the door, at the window, to watch my car. I had a van at the time, to watch my van. Well, actually, I had two cars, but I used my van for business. And to make certain that nobody busted through the windows. And I also had to cover the merchandise, the boxes of, you know, my suitcases and whatnot in the back of my van with a big sheet just to prevent people from, you know, busting the windows. I don't know. I only went there a few times because, quite frankly, it was kind of scary. And I met this customer at a trade show, and really when I said, yeah, I'll just come to your store, I had no idea where exactly I was. I didn't know it was going to be that dangerous. So I must say I didn't go there very often, but it was kind of scary. And I was very happy to get the heck out of there at the end of my business. But, yeah, Chicago does have a reputation for being, well, a scary place to live. And of course, I think one of the reasons, too, is that the gun laws in Chicago, I don't live in Chicago, I live in the suburbs, but the gun laws there just prohibit anybody. You can't buy ammunition, you can't buy guns, but all the criminals have guns.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's probably the same way in Mexico.
Well, you know, Mexico is an interesting place. And I have to say that the media representation of Mexico is a little distorted. I mean, there are areas, no question about it, along the southwestern border that are controlled by various drug gangs. But I've been living in Rosarito Beach now for the past 4 years. And I have to say, I've never come across a situation that has ever caused me any concern whatsoever. But then again, I also live in a gated community, if you will.
Okay. So are you suggesting that perhaps the media reports the worst instead of the best? Whether you're talking about Chicago or Mexico or South Africa?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, I don't want to take away from the the fact, you know, that South Africa has its problems, but no more different than the U.S. or any other country has its problems.
But what didn't it get worse after Mandela, after apartheid ended? Didn't the slaughter and all of the problems increase? I mean, after he took power and after he after apartheid ended?
I wouldn't say that things got more violent. I would say that they instituted policies that attempted to obviously reverse years of the effects of apartheid. And one of the probably most egregious was a thing that they referred to as BEE, which is an Equal Opportunity Act. In other words, what it means is if a company has a position open and if there's a black applicant and a white applicant, preference has to be given, irrespective of qualification, preference has to be given to the black over the white.
Okay, isn't that the same kind of thing that happened beginning in the 60s in this country, that despite qualifications and education and whatnot, equal opportunity was actually, you know, that a lot of people, well, even in getting into certain colleges.
In South Africa today, it's discrimination in reverse.
Right.
And the lessons that Americans should learn from the events that have unfolded in South Africa, there is no amount of laws you can pass that is going to equal or level the playing field for all. I mean, that's a progressive utopian myth that you can ever operate on a level playing field. There's no level playing field.
Everybody's born. The only equality people should have is equality before the law, because we all are born different. We all have different propensities, different intellects, different talents. So there's no way that you can be equal to anybody else. But in South Africa, I mean, you hear about the necklacing, you hear about the lack of the police, you hear about, well, I mean, you can, there's not sufficient police to take care of the crime. Isn't that true?
Well, the level of crime in South Africa, depending on whose matrix you use, is either the highest murder rate in the world or pretty close to it. But one has to look deeper down into the numbers to see you know, what the actual figures are, because what a lot of folks don't understand is a large part of the violence that takes place in South Africa is between various tribal factions.
Is that true even in urban areas, though?
Oh, absolutely. There are the predominant Zulu nation in South Africa is the Khoza tribe, which is the tribe Mandela is a part of. And then there are the Zulus, which, although a minority, have always been revered for their dominance of the Khoisas. And so there's always a tribal equation that one has to consider. If you simply look at the number of white farmers in South Africa who have been murdered since the end of apartheid, I mean...
Well, right. I mean, South Africa used to have sufficient produce and agriculture to feed the nation, and since apartheid, some of those farms have been taken over by people who weren't qualified to actually operate them, and they now produce nothing.
Absolutely. But you've also got to take into account that, you know, the numbers are skewed.
Okay. In what respect?
Well, farmers in rural areas obviously are at greater risk just simply because of their location than farmers within populated areas who are afforded at least minimal police protection. Rural farmers are pretty much on their own.
So we have a bunch of people, groups traveling in the rural areas just to slaughter white farmers?
Well, you've also got to take into account that there are thousands of Africans from other parts of Africa that have made their way to I've got an audio problem here with interference. I think I got rid of it. Anyway, you've had thousands of blacks that have moved to South Africa, especially Nigerians are in large part responsible for a major percentage of the crimes that are committed.
Okay, let's get back to the labor unions, the diamonds, who runs the industry. If unemployment is a big issue there, what is causing that issue? Why is there lack of employment? Because the minute you have a lot of unemployed people, you're going to have a lot of problems. And, of course, communism appeals to the oppressed. So was Mandela a communist? You said that he had sympathy towards that ideology. So was he a communist, and were the Jews running him? Were they managing him his whole career? And if so, and if that was the case, how did he end up in jail? Who put him in jail? Was it because he stopped being obedient to his masters? What was the deal there?
Well, South Africa has a very long, interesting relationship with Israel, and the reason for that is...
Because they have a lot of resources?
Well, not so much that, but when the U.S. Congress started to feel the pressure to do something about South Africa's apartheid policies, so the first thing, as America always does, is impose limited sanctions on South Africa, which, if you remember back, one of the many criticisms of Ronald Reagan was he was reluctant to push for additional sanctions against South Africa, but the Congressional Black Caucus was very successful forcing the U.S. to impose a complete ban of any form of military assistance to South Africa.
Okay.
And so this opened the window for South Africa to form stronger relationships with Israel.
Because they practice apartheid in Israel.
Well, the Israeli form of apartheid is far more severe than anything that was practiced in South Africa. I mean, if you see photographs of Palestine today, you see what is akin to the Berlin Wall separating Palestine from Israel. South Africa never erected walls between blacks and whites, but obviously they do in Israel. South African military cooperation with Israeli military goes back decades. As a matter of fact, if it was not for that close relationship, Israel would have no nukes today because it was the sharing of nuclear technology that not only gave South Africa the bomb, but obviously gave Israel many nuclear weapons that make up its current arsenal.
True. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is causing all of the unemployment there, and who is in charge of the corporations? Because it's the corporations that control labor, and they also control the government. So who owns or who sits on the boards of those corporations that control Africa?
Well, the funny thing is it's pretty much the same people that have been in control since South Africa's inception. In other words, De Beers.
Okay, we're talking about the Jews, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And the Jews still own most of the corporations that came in and took over the gold, the diamond mining, and you said you mentioned before that the Dutch control the labor unions. They've never really controlled the labor unions here. I mean, the Jews have always been in charge of the labor unions in this country. And the labor unions usually exercise their power with their members in order to get certain politicians elected. For instance, with Roosevelt, it was the labor unions that initially got him elected. And then, of course, is that the same way?
Well, Kennedy was without question elected because of the support of the union. Kennedy's father played a big part in getting labor to support JFK's presidential bid.
But for different reasons. There was a different reason between getting Roosevelt elected and Kennedy elected. Kennedy was very much against the Jews, had been the whole time that he was ambassador to England, whereas Roosevelt, the labor unions played a big part in getting him elected because he would go along with the Jewish policies. Which he did, and of course his administration was absolutely full of communists, and communist is another word for Jew.
And let me just throw you a curveball here for just a second.
Okay.
One of strange political bedfellows that emerged in the 70s in America was the ADL was de facto intelligence gathering source for the South African government. As a matter of fact, it was the ADL that reported back to the South African government about anti-apartheid activities in the U.S., and it was also the ADL that pressured then Assistant Defense Secretary Dick Cheney to declare Nelson Mandela and the ANC terrorists.
Okay.
Now, what was kind of ironic is when he was vice president under George Bush and Condoleezza Rice was the Secretary of State, the U.S. wanted to award Nelson Mandela the Congressional Medal of Honor, but there was a small problem. Because he was designated a terrorist by the U.S. State Department, he was not able to travel to the U.S., so they had to make a special accommodation for Mandela to travel to the U.S. and subsequently was given the Congressional Medal of Honor by George Bush.
Well, that's, well, that's interesting.
And no sooner had Mandela received the Congressional Medal of Honor from George Bush than he jumped on a plane and flew to Cuba to thank Fidel Castro personally for the support he received over the many years.
Oh, well, that is interesting because, I mean, there's still Cuba is still sanctioned, has been. It's the longest sanction of any country in history. They're still under sanction. And so that's very interesting that he would receive an award from this government, from Bush's administration. And, I mean, so he had loyalties to a lot of entities, apparently.
Well, and I think in large part that was, the reason why in the Carter interview on Al Jazeera TV why he wasn't very positive about Mandela's lack of gratitude towards the U.S. after his release.
Now, how did he happen to get out? Just was it a humanitarian kind of a thing, or I really don't know. How did he get out?
Mandela was...
And who put him away to begin with?
Well, first of all, the former apartheid government of South Africa obviously found him guilty of treason and acts of terror, which were credited to his armed wing of the ANC in Kada with Suiza, which translates into the spear of the shield. And his release was without question predicated on worldwide support that was manufactured
by the media?
By the media, absolutely.
Okay. So, and we all know who controls the media. Okay, why don't we take a 5-minute break? Let's take a 5-minute break. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Let's see, we have some email. Let's see if we have an email question for you. Let's see. Okay. That wasn't a question. So we're talking about South Africa, and I asked you about the corporate structure there and asked you if it was the same structure that we experience here in America. And do you anticipate that America will go the same way as South Africa has gone, where you have violence, high unemployment, blacks against whites, all the violence? Now, I know that you said that there wasn't that much more violence there than here. But I still, you know, I still kind of wonder about that because, you know, I have interviewed other people who've told me that, who have been there recently and have told me about the situation there, and it sounds pretty dreadful. It's not any place that I would want to go. It's like if I want to go back to that street in South Chicago, I probably wouldn't want to go there.
Well,
so what about the structure there?
Well, let me, you know, once again reiterate that, you know, on my recent trip to South Africa, it pretty much was as I remembered it from 30 years ago. And although there's no question that violence is a problem, it is no worse.
I don't know, Robbie. I mean, when Trayvon Martin was killed, I mean, we heard about it for weeks and weeks. I've seen the pictures on Monica Stone's website of all these children slaughtered, of all of these women raped and mutilated, and I think, and we don't hear anything about that. Not a thing about that, and. So I just have to question. And also, what about they put a tire around somebody's neck and put gasoline all over it and then ignite it? I mean, that's something that if that happened in America, all heck would break loose.
Well, by and large, that practice of necklacing, by and large, was meted out to blacks who were thought of as being collaborators, if you will, with the government. These weren't sort of, you know, events that happened in a vacuum. And although it got a lot of media attention just because of the horrific nature of it. I mean, the only other thing that I can equate it to is if you remember, you know, prior to the U.S.'s adventures in Iraq, how we used to see numerous videos of people having their heads sliced off.
That was the media. And right. That was something that I believe was was orchestrated, and that was justification for the United States military to go into Iraq. But the pictures that I see online with all these innocent children and women, and you mentioned yourself, the white farmers out, you know, in an isolated area were getting slaughtered. So, I mean, it's a fact that people are getting slaughtered in South Africa.
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, and I'm by no means trying to make light of, you know, Africa is not for sissies.
No, and from what I understand, according to someone in the chat room, there has been at least 3,000 events of necklacing that caused death. And even Dan Rather, who obviously worked for he was very compromised and worked for the media, he mentioned it. I heard him talking about it, I don't know, 3 years ago or so. And there's also a genocide museum. I mean, that's pretty bad that genocide is so prevalent that they create a museum and with all the pictures, the Afrikaner Genocide Museum.
Well, that's, you know, when you also got to put something else into context, and it was,
yes,
you know, the British that established the first concentration camps.
They established concentration camps. They weren't necessarily the first, but they were certainly significant. And they put, what was it, 27,000, well, at least 27,000 women died, or women, children, and men, but that was a low figure according to other people that I've chatted with.
Well, it's a low figure until you obviously do the math based on what the population was at the time.
Well, the fact that the British established concentration camps, and they also went around, they salted the wells, they did all kinds of things, destroyed the fields. What was the purpose of that?
Well, just like the British attempted to get hold of Cornwallis, the swamp fox. You know, Cornwallis was the British general who...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they thought that by imprisoning the woman and the children, it would cut off aid and support to the Boers at the time.
Sure. Now, can you relate that to the activities of the ANC? I know there's several generations in between those, but can you relate that behavior to the behavior of the ANC, and what were some of their activities? I mean, Mandela was a terrorist. He was a terrorist.
Oh, there's no disputing that fact whatsoever.
Okay.
But as you know, that old saying, and I hate to throw this one at you, but one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. As a matter of fact, the thing that I find ironic about Obama's statements about his support of Nelson Mandela, had the U.S. Terrorism Act been in place while Obama was in college, there's no question he would have been guilty of giving aid and comfort to a terrorist organization.
I guess you could say the same thing right now. I mean, if you consider who he works for. So, about the ANC, it was a terrorist organization, and Mandela was a terrorist, and although apartheid ended, was supposed to be a good thing, there was more terrorism after apartheid ended than before. The blacks in South Africa were in better shape under apartheid than they were after. So, who was running?
There's no question. You will find many blacks in South Africa that will tell you that life for them was decidedly better under apartheid than it is today.
Okay.
I mean, none of the promises that Mandela made of leveling the playing field, if you will, came to fruition while he was president of South Africa. South Africa is currently, for want of a better word, right now in a world of hurt.
And was this deliberate? I can't help but think that this is a deliberate situation, that They put him in power, jail. He was a martyr. He became a martyr. Now, you said that in Johannesburg that a Jewish law firm took Mandela under their wing.
Yep.
And so they used him. They exploited him. And, of course, if it took going to jail and whatever else it took, it accomplished something that I think is what we see in South Africa today. The country's in a mess. So how can people think that he was wonderful? How could people be moaning and groaning because he's dead and saying what a wonderful person he was and all this other stuff when he destroyed the country under the jurisdiction of the Jews who put him in power and made certain that he had this education that he could use to do what he did, and the fact that he was a terrorist and had communist sympathies?
Well, you know, as I said to you before, in large part, he is credited, you know, by both blacks and whites of averting ultimately what would have been a major bloodbath in the 70s after the assassination of Chris Hani. I mean, Africa's history, you've got to understand, first of all, the Afrikaners have their own Nostradamus, if you will, who pretty much predicted that as soon as the blacks took over control of southern Africa, it was, for want of a better word, the beginning of the end.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still a but smaller community that still believes that a racial war will ultimately unfold. Now, what form that takes, your guess is as good as mine, because right now the ANC is no longer the vaunted political party of Nelson Mandela. They had, you know, their time in order to implement the changes that were promised to the majority of blacks, and obviously failing in that mission. South Africa
Wasn't that a deliberate failure? I mean, I think it's as much of a failure as the civil rights movement. I mean, after the civil rights movement, there's more blacks that are having issues, that are unemployed, more black abortions. It has been a disaster. And isn't it the same way? Isn't it the same as what happened in South Africa, all these promises, and yet it's made their life worse than better? And wasn't that deliberate, you think?
Well, not going to be solved by any of the current crop of politicians in South Africa today. Pretty much like South Africa is void of any leadership, which you could make the same argument for the USA.
Sure.
I mean, the U.S.'s prospects for the next election are not really...
What prospects?
Well...
I don't see any prospects at all.
Well, it looks as though the odds as they currently stand favor America's first woman president in the form of Hillary Clinton. There's nobody of any interest emerging.
Well, the people don't exactly have a choice anyway. We get either the Marxists have somebody that they want us to select, or the Zionists have somebody that they want us to select. It all comes from the same forum. Now, what exactly is your background? Were your ethnic background? Were you Dutch? Were you German?
I was born in Rhodesia, so I grew up singing God Save the Queen.
Okay, but what is your background? Were you Dutch? Were you German? Were you from Holland? Where were you from? Where did your ancestors come from when they went to Rhodesia?
Well, here's the interesting part of how I ended up where I ended up. My grandfather was one of many British who
Okay, so he was from Britain? Where was he from?
Yeah, he was from Britain. There was a call in the 1800s for volunteers to go to South Africa to help secure the British Empire in Africa. And the one problem they discovered was that because there were only men, the British soldiers at the time were starting to look favorably on the local black woman. And so there was a major PR effort on behalf of the British government at the time to get women to migrate to South Africa to take care of the troops. And
okay.
My grandmother at the time thought it would be a pretty adventurous thing to do to go to Africa.
So you're part of the, your ancestor was a British soldier that was there, part of the Boer War?
Absolutely. He was a member of the British Royal Dragoon Guard, and obviously my grandmother was one of the many British women who answered the call, moved to South Africa, obviously met my grandfather.
So you're telling us?
What happened after that, I have absolutely no idea.
So you're telling us that your ancestor fought against the Boers in South Africa?
Yep.
Whoa, okay. Well, that's interesting. And so when you said that, talked about the concentration camps that the British were instituted, you were talking about your ancestors doing that?
Well, it was at that time, yeah.
Holy cow, Robbie.
And then I came to the land of the free and the home of the brave, and let me just say that as soon as America instituted its war on terror, it was almost deja vu for me all over again, because I'm a strong believer that although history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, there are times where it comes awfully close.
Now, do you think... what about the war against Iraq and Afghanistan? Do you think that the U.S. government should have gone in there?
Not at all. But like all wars, it's a war for resources.
For who? I mean, the United States didn't need any resources, but the United States are the ones that furnished the killers. And the people that went over there to snatch resources and kill foreigners that didn't do anything to them.
Well, first of all, you got to understand that the U.S.'s number one priority is to protect the status of the petrodollar.
But this had nothing to do with gas or oil. It had something to do with allowing Israel to have hegemony in the Middle East.
Well, the original war against Saddam Hussein was not because he attacked Kuwait, or was because he was attempting to sell Iraqi oil in euros as opposed to dollars.
No, the reason they attacked Saddam Hussein is because he said, no, I'm not going to allow the U.S. corporations to come in and take my people's profits. Our profits, the resources of this country, are going to remain under the jurisdiction of the citizens who live here, and they are going to be the benefactors thereof. And shortly thereafter, when Rumsfeld went over and asked him about this and told him what the U.S. expected, or what the Jews expected from Iraq, he said, no, thank you, we're not going to cooperate with you. That is when the U.S. government decided to send soldiers over there to destroy his country and take out all the electrical power. They had 4% electricity left over in 1991. They also killed 500,000 children under the sanctions that the U.S. government imposed at the behest of the Jews. That story that we always hear in the so-called truth movement is a bunch of lies.
Well, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. I don't have to tell you about that. I mean, you know that as well as I do.
Well, that is so true. That is so true. But in any event, whatever we hear in the mass media, whatever we're told, we always have to look at what happens to a country if they're not obedient to the internationalists, to the Jews, to the bankers. They get bombed to hell. That is what happens to them.
Well, sure. I mean,
that's what happened to Germany. That's what happened to Iraq. That's what happened to Afghanistan. And it is because they aren't obedient. And so when we hear these stupid stories about, oh, we've got to go over there and impose democracy and we've got to do this and that, no. It is to take over because somebody wants to be a nationalist. Saddam Hussein was a nationalist. He was about people for his country.
Sure. Same can be said for Muammar Gaddafi.
Exactly. Look what they did to his country. He got all that water. He put in all that irrigation. He's the one that made the desert bloom like a rose. And so what do? They go in there and they destroy that. And it was for the Jews, for the hegemony of the Jews. Nothing more. It didn't have anything whatsoever to do with the fact that he was doing whatever they said he was doing that they had to go in there and bomb him for.
Well, that can lead straight to, obviously, the current situation with Syria.
Exactly. We're not being told the truth about Syria.
Of course not. I mean, and what I find interesting is how the royal family of Saudi joined forces with Israel.
Well, that's because they're Jews. The Saudi family are Jews. They've always been Jews ever since, for at least over 100 years.
And, you know, just as a sidebar, an interesting little footnote here, out of the 36 world leaders who flew to South Africa to attend the Mandela commemoration, you know the single world leader that never showed up?
Who?
Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, why do you think that is?
Your guess on that one, my dear, is as good as mine. I have absolutely no idea why, according to the Israeli embassy,
had a headache?
He couldn't find time in his rather busy schedule to make the trip.
Well, he's too busy planning more warfare, planning things for the U.S. military to engage in.
Well, you also know that one of the other South Africans that caused Israel great consternation was Desmond Tutu.
Really? What did he do?
Well, he was the first to publicly draw comparison between Israel's policy towards the Palestinians and South Africa's apartheid government's policy towards the blacks. And obviously that didn't go over too well with the Israelis. To make matters worse, statements that Tutu made were echoed in Jimmy Carter's recent book about events in the Middle East.
Right. Now, what was the name of that book? I've never read his books because, quite frankly, I mean, he's just a puppet. He was a puppet when they put him in, and he's always been a puppet. He's always provided orchestrated opposition for things, when in fact he was always working for the Rockefellers. He was always he was a charter member of the Trilateral Organization.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they only put him in because he pretended to be some sort of a Christian and taught Sunday school and wore a sweater and just, I don't know. He just had this very unique personality, but he was just, and he was just as evil as the rest of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was a charter member of the Trilateral Commission. So anyway, so what book did he write?
It was his recent. It was a recent book he wrote where, obviously, the Zionists got into a kerfuffle because of comparing Israel and South Africa.
Okay, let's see. What books is he wrote one about apartheid. Palestine peace, not apartheid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, he was a wimp and made people think that. He made a lot of promises that he couldn't fulfill, but he was working for him just like every other one every other president has. Okay. Well, so what do you foresee? What do you see happening in South Africa from here forward?
Well, the optimist in me would like to see.
Do you see happening? We'd all like to be optimistic about our own countries. And
yeah, absolutely. Well, I can't see the ANC have a coming to Jesus moment. Its popularity up until this point was solely for and because of Nelson Mandela. But if you watched the commemoration that took place on Saturday, the appearance of Jacob Zuma was greeted with a loud chorus of boos. In other words, the ANC's mission right now is not only to find a charismatic leader, but also it has to repair a lot of the damage that it has done over the past.
Do you really see that happening, Robbie? I mean, seriously. I think they did what they were supposed to do. I don't see that they're going to have any kind of resurrection or that they're going to repair any kind of damage, because I think the damage was deliberate. They've been successful. They've destroyed the country. They've destroyed many of the citizens in the country, both black and white. And I think that's what their job was. And what do you think the Christian Zionists think about this?
Well, unfortunately, Christian Zionism is well established in Southern Africa. As a matter of fact, one of the things that blew my mind, I was driving through a small town on the outskirts of Durban, and right before me was a huge billboard that had been erected courtesy of James Dobson.
Ugh, what a piece of trash that guy is.
Such a
phony hypocrite.
So, unfortunately, Christian Zionism is very much alive and well in South Africa.
And they see what is going on as, I mean, they are for Israel. Now, you have Charles Carlson on your program on a very frequent basis, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh. He's a fine gentleman, very nice person.
He is the man that I credit for helping me put the pieces of the puzzle together many years ago in my early American political education, when I didn't question the likes of.
Now, did you believe people like Dobson?
I was sympathetic towards Billy Graham, James Dobson. As a matter of fact, I was on a radio station in Colorado in a little town called Johnstown called American Freedom, where James Dobson was a regular on my show. And I had no idea of what him and Focus on the Family was all about.
One of his ex-employees did a big expose on him. It's very interesting.
Well, as you know, Focus on the Family has this huge complex in Colorado Springs, which is conveniently located right next to the Air Force Academy.
Right, which is filled with all kinds of Christian Zionists. And as far as Billy Graham, I mean, that guy was the Freemason. He was terrible. And they put him in just to fight the communism. And he was, well, the media puffed him up and made him something really big. In fact, Henry Luce said, Puff Graham, that the media created him.
Well, the unfortunate thing is it looks as though Franklin Graham is following in his...
Gosh, I wonder why.
...his father's footsteps.
Well, sure. I mean, it was very profitable for his father, so of course he's going to follow in his father's footsteps. Yikes. Well, I feel sorry for the people in South Africa. I feel sorry for the people in Palestine. I feel sorry for the people in the United States. Well, we are all under horrible occupation, and we need to recognize exactly who the enemy is, and we need to fight that enemy. So it's been very interesting having you on the program today.
Well, I thank you so much, Deanna, and I really appreciate the time you afforded me.
Okay, and your website again, that's Robbie Noel, RobbyNoel.com. And I would like to remind our listeners about the wonderful American Free Press. Please, please consider giving the American Free Press to your friends and relatives. It is a gift that keeps on giving throughout the year. It is a gift of knowledge. It's the best newspaper that you can buy. And it's probably the last newspaper in America that is free speech, where you're going to get the truth. They have wonderful reporters. And also, please consider the Barnes Review. I love the Barnes Review. It is basically what woke me up to world history, to World War II. Fabulous articles, and I hope that you will subscribe to both the Barnes Review and the American Free Press for yourself as well as for family and friends. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Spingola Zone.
Thanks, Deanna.
Thank you, Robbie.